This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am, again, Rob Coulter, as I am every week. With me is the high-performance coach for the Countrymen, Nathan Cooper-Brown. Welcome, Coops.
Great to be back.
We also have the high-performance coach for the Vic Metro Men, Darren Best. Welcome, Bestie.
Hello, everyone.
It's fantastic to have you all back on. As we mentioned last week, you can now follow the Talking Split socials on Twitter and Instagram using the @TalkingSplit handle. If you have it, that's our attempt to try and get Bestie back onto social media. Failing?
Miserably.
Yep, as always. At least we are nothing if not consistent. So where you can, if you could please give that a follow, that'd be fantastic. We are going to try and start to get some coaching clips and articles up on there over the next couple of weeks when we're going out and about with various courses, clinics, camps, whatever we've got going on. We're going to try and put some content up on there as well. So if you can get that up there, that would be fantastic. Something we do want to touch on before we get into the actual meat of the podcast is that from the 15th to the 21st of May this year is National Volunteer Week. So we know that coaches are largely volunteers. They spend a lot of their hours doing a lot of things for other people in that space. So there are tons of people that we do need to thank in this space that we look at in the volunteer world. So what we are asking for is for the listeners out there to give us some shout-outs in the way of a voice recording. You can send that into us at BV. You can send that to my email address. You can use the DMs on the Twitter handle as well. Just a voice recording with this person does a lot for me or is great in my space. We really appreciate them. So that might be a DOC or a coordinator giving like props to their coaches from within their program. It might be the coach giving thanks to their mentor. It might be a player giving a shout out to a coach they've really enjoyed having some interaction and some coaching from as well. And we'll play those on the podcast because it is shockingly, and I know I'm talking to two people that know this very well, like, coaching can be a little lonely at times and you don't always get the thanks that you maybe should get. So from that end, we do want to make sure that we reach out and we try and promote this as best we possibly can. So we're giving you fair run-up on this one, knowing full well that most people will probably do this the night before, which is like my assignment is due tomorrow on the Sunday, also known as Rob's Year 12. So you can get that through to me via email or via the socials and we'll get that on here. So if you can do that, that would be fantastic. We'll obviously try and get something from you guys as well as Jenny and Zoe on here. But it would be great to be able to really thank the volunteers in this space because coaching can be a little bit of a brutal one at times where you certainly question, why? Why am I still doing this? Why am I putting myself through this? It's that kind of thing. We know why. We're idiots. We love it. Like it's fantastic. But we do want to make sure that the right people are getting thanked in this space as well.
Well, great time for Rob. Reece Smith, one of my best assets when I was at Casey, has sadly passed away just recently from a long battle of cancer. But he was exactly that. He was he would coach 3 or 4 domestic teams, a rep team. He would do the all inclusions basketball. He would coach Aussie hoops. And even still when he was, after a chemo treatment would come in and say, Darren, is it right if I'd bring a chair for practice? So sadly, he's just passed away. Want to show some love to Reece Smith.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of those things that you don't really know the asset that some of these people are to their associations as well. Like that's someone that Casey will feel the loss of from a personal level, of course, but also from a resource level. We don't just have endless supplies of coaches and people involved. So that would be a great thing. I'll remind everyone every week on the podcast. So from around about the 2.5 minute mark to the 3.5 minute mark every week in the pod, you can probably just skip forward and just get to the actual meat of the content.
If you've done your recording, Rob.
If I've done my recording. No guarantee. Like there's absolutely no guarantee on that. So what we are going to talk about today, and on the back of the assistant coaches one from last week, which got a fair bit of traction with people sort of saying, actually, we didn't really take into account how much assistant coaches do and how valuable they are in this coaching space, which is great. There is probably a part two of the assistant coach pod coming, along with a part three of the senior coaching pod. Now, the thing about it, we may be backlogged a little here, but it is one of those things that directors of coaching and coaching coordinators, again, largely volunteers. There are some that are certainly paid to be in that role for sure. And I know I'm talking to you two that have fulfilled this role in different capacities over the years for a number of times. I've been in that myself. How did you decide? I suppose we'll start with you, Coops, because you did it in regional Victoria as well. How did you decide you actually wanted to be a director of coaching or in that space?
Yeah, funny enough, the decision was almost made for me. I went for a job at Basketball Victoria, which was the coach development officer. I can't remember who they gave it to. But
the guy was no good though.
Yeah, I know. I was pretty sure he was rubbish. But anyway, in a fit of rage that I obviously missed out on that job. Part of the feedback that I got was actually that I'd never filled that role before. I'd never been in charge of a program, that I obviously hadn't gained that experience. And just in this attempt to, you know, try and get a job in basketball to, you know, to be able to have a vocation and live my passion and be paid for it. I was actively looking for any jobs that would help that, and obviously developing coaches, or obviously the role I'm in now was part of that. And yeah, the feedback came back that, you know, this is something you were missing. And then it just happened to be that a little bit later, the job I'm in now came up, and again I went very close and missed out, and again similar feedback came back. But then Ballarat Basketball was looking for a DOC, and they came through Basketball Victoria and said, hey, you know, we're looking for somebody. And thanks to BV, because they turned around and said, hey, have you thought about Nathan Cooper Brown? And that's why I got in touch with those guys. And obviously that's now a part of my journey. So, yeah, it was really helpful. It allowed me just to be involved in basketball. It allowed me to be paid to be involved in basketball, which is obviously a dream come true. And yeah, I look back on my time as a DOC very fondly.
Yep. What about you, Bestie? Because you've done it in a number of different states, obviously, in different types of roles. Like sometimes they've been full-time positions, sometimes they've been,
yep,
I'll say quote-unquote voluntary, but like those casual type roles. Like, how did you end up there?
Well, it started for me when I was playing QBL, which is now what is NBL 1 North. And literally I was just asked to come into a meeting one night, and I was like, yeah, sure, why not? I've got nothing else to do. And we're in there, and there was a whole bunch of committee members patting each other on the back. They had just amalgamated three associations to become one. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is pretty cool. I'm like, yeah, I'll coach a team, no problem. And I was like, oh, so when are trials? And they're like, we don't have them yet. I said, oh, okay. When's the season start? And they're like, 3 weeks.
Brilliant.
And literally everybody was sitting in a circle. You know, it was a real kumbaya moment. And I physically picked my chair up and slid it backwards. I was like, whoa, you know, this is not what I'm used to, having come through the Victorian system, you know. And they're like, oh, you know, would you be interested in trying to help us sort it out? I was like, yeah, no worries. And I reckon I did it for maybe 2 weeks. And I said to them, we need a salary here, you know. And this is what, you know, I said to you before the podcast, if you're at an association that has 20 or more teams, and your DOC only has 20 to 25 hours paid to them, lower your expectations. Like, it's physically impossible. Yep. It's not enough. You go there on a Friday night, you're there for, you know, 6-7 hours. Maybe you go to practice once a week on a Sunday or whatever. Then you deal with an enormous amount of admin. You know, it's actually very hard for them to truly contribute to a program that's 20 teams or more with only 20, 25 hours. And I'll double down and say, if you're at an association that has more teams than that, doesn't have a full-time DOC or development manager, but invest significant amount of money into a senior program, you should get yourself to the AGM, because the priorities aren't right.
Where they can also push their chair backwards a little bit if they don't like what they're hearing.
Well, I just think, like, you know, you got to spend the money on developing the kids, because otherwise your senior program is just only buying outside players.
Yep.
You know, it takes time. Trust me, yeah. It takes a lot of time to get it done. But it's just, yeah, you know, people, they really need to, you know, find out what the priorities are before they go and join a club. I think.
And that is the big investment to it. Like, it's, I mean, we talk about it a lot. I mean, I think it's a little bit different from regional Victoria to metro Melbourne, for sure. Like, it's, you know, Ballarat is one of the bigger associations out there, especially in regional Victoria. But if you're from one of the smaller towns, like Yarram, no disrespect to anyone from Yarram, like, we get it. But they probably can't afford a full-time director of coaching. Like, they're just happy for anyone to put their hand up. It's sort of similar to those coaching roles. They're just content for anyone to put their hand up and say, yeah, I'll take on the extra responsibility in this space. So I think it is something that we all, when I say we all, probably not people in this room, I think we kind of get it for what it is, but a lot of parents and players out there that feel like their director of coaching is effectively just the complaints board.
Yeah.
That's not what they're there for.
Yeah.
We'd have to be really mindful of that too, that, again, on the back of the volunteer stuff we spoke about, if you have 15 hours a week, I can guarantee you'll spend 10 of it dealing with problems, maybe more. That only leaves you really 5 hours to actually do your job and then try and progress and build something. Like, that balances out.
Yeah,
like,
and this is why I said, if you've got 20 teams or more, it's, you know, your associations have to find a way to get someone on staff.
Yep.
It just has to happen.
And it's vital. Like, without the right leadership, I think, as a director of coaching or a coaching coordinator or whatever it is. And we do see a lot of these roles too, I think, combined with another role within the association. So it might be a full-time person that works for the association but is a director of coaching and, you know, basketball development officer or something like that that's responsible for, say, Aussie Hoops and camps and those types of things. Okay, that can work, but understand that there will be times probably where they're not as available as normal because they've been dealing with camps for 2 weeks straight and the last thing they want to look at is a basketball court. Like, it's just kind of how it rolls, I suppose, in that space too. So how did you go about juggling your workload, Coops? Like, I know it was a full-time role in Ballarat, but how did you go about making sure that you got the most out of what you had available to you?
Yeah, I mean, it was a full-time role, incredibly engrossing. One, just because of the magnitude of the role, and then two, you know, I'd like to think because of the passion and attention to detail that I'd like to bring to it, or I like to bring to it. I was lucky. The CEO at the time, who's very well known and in our community, in Peter Eddy, you know, he'd had some pretty special people come through Ballarat and have that role or be coaches. You know, a number of Australian coaches, and it's really quite a unique place. He was really hands on. He was really protective of me and my time and understanding where I wanted to go in coaching and how that related to the club. One of the things that he had me do straight away was basically create a timesheet in Excel, and I had to monitor my hours, and he was on it. And if the hours got away from me, he was pretty much, mate, get out of here. You know, like, oh, you know, I've got, you know, youth training or whatever on a Wednesday night. He'd be like, I don't care. Like, go home, you need some rest. So I was really lucky to have him in that space. I was lucky to have him with an understanding of what the pathway looked like, what the community looked like, and when I needed to put more time in, he was understanding. But I also very quickly worked out, you know, how I needed to prioritize my time. You know, I would, you know, get the balance where I needed to in terms of just, you know, creating some priority lists, creating some to-do lists, you know, looking at ways in which I could potentially connect parts of the program to obviously, you know, maximize time. Like, one of the things that we did, which I know a lot of senior programs do now, but it works really well in regional Victoria, was connect our under-18s, our youth league, and our SEBL team all together. So it was awesome for me there to be able to get across three teams in one night, you know, support those guys. We did a lot of stuff in the morning where we connected different parts of the program, which also was really helpful. So, you know, it wasn't easy. It was a balancing act, but it was helpful to have people at the program that supported me, to have people understand where I wanted to go, and then obviously to put the time into to make sure I was managing, I was prioritising and giving everything I could to the club.
Yep. Bestie, you've just come off a role at Casey, obviously, that really encompassed a lot of this. And it's funny, talking to Dave Peters not too long ago, he's like, yeah, but this is not a 40-hour-a-week role. Like, it's up around like the 55, 60 hours at times.
Mm. Yeah.
Were you just super efficient, or did you have the same experience when you were there?
Well, I'm way better than him. And I will say that Dave is one of my longest standing close friends, so he knows I'm just having a dig. But no, it was. Yep. It was, you know, 55 to 60 hours.
Yep.
You know, and that's just, you know, and the line is really blurred because it's, you know, when are you volunteering?
Yep.
Because you still volunteer for your club, you know, because it is your club when you're there. So, you know, the way I managed my time was similarly. I had a great GM in Tammy Bauer. And, you know, even when I worked up in Queensland, I had good people on the board, Gail Jones and such. But we did a weekly plan, and I would have 2 weekly meetings with the GM to just, you know, go over where I was at with things and what needed to be done to avoid, you know, just that sort of constant, you know, feeling of just having a chat. You know, we just scheduled meetings, had agendas, really punched it out. And then, you know, when I first started there, I said to Tammy, oh, you know, we need another staff member. And she said, that won't happen, Darren. We've only just finally got someone full time. 12 months later, we had another one. And then I was like, we're going to get another one. You know, and now they do. Like, they've got 3 full time people that now in development. One of them's a job share with BV in Nick Mihai, but you've got to be able to balance it so that the Casey role not only encompassed 44 rep teams, it also encompassed 300 plus kids a week doing Aussie hoops. We had three different academies that had anywhere between 150 to 200 kids a week doing those. We had sporting school visits that was, you know, every week, you know, and this is what I would say. There's ways that you can generate revenue, you know, and free clinics for kids and all those types of things. And to be honest, it just helped that it was probably one of the only spots in Victoria that you could afford land. So, you know, the
growth corridor is real.
Yeah, the municipality just exploded, you know, so that helped.
Yeah, I certainly know when I was, for those of you that may not be aware, did work at Victoria Police for a little while before coming into the BV role. Victoria Police subsidised a lot of basketball hours, it would turn out over the years, because I was doing a part-time DOC type role at an association, but also working for VicPol at the time and just trying to work out where are my hours, where am I going? I can only get this person between these hours because they're a shift worker. So if I need to talk to them about something, it has to be here. I was like, well, it's going to have to be on my work time more than anything else. So trying to manage just when you're going there, where you're going, what venue you're going to. Like if you're at one of those associations that might have two or three of them, it's like, damn it, I've turned up to the wrong place. And I still do that. Like I went to a game which I thought was at Ringwood on Friday night and turns out it wasn't at Ringwood. They were playing Ringwood, but playing it at the place that I just left. So those sort of dumb things you still manage to find ways to do. But just the management side of things, if you're not organised as a director of coaching or a coaching coordinator, you failed before you started. You just have no chance. Like if people can't get a hold of you, same sort of deal. They need to be able to know what are your hours, what's the window where I know I can get them in whatever capacity that is. Now, sometimes that's just a chat. Sometimes it's something a little bit more formal. It might be an email, whatever the case may be. But you've got to try and manage your hours to the point where you're not accessible 24/7 too. Because I think that's a valuable part of it is that we, you know, we as coaches give a lot to this stuff. We can't always be there. Like at some point, your family life's going to suffer, your personal life's going to suffer because you are trying to help out so many people, which comes from a good place, of course, but you know, you do have to be just mindful in that space too.
We need to have processes in place
for
conflict resolution, for example. And then I would always try to be only just approachable. And I know that sounds slightly rude.
No, that's roughly your personality, Bessie, I guess.
But the reality is I want you to know if it's serious, you come to me. But, you know, don't come and talk to me on a Friday when I'm sitting there watching two games because it's not for my enjoyment. You know, I'm there working.
Yep.
So, and, you know, we spoke about when is it appropriate to talk to a coach and all that stuff on a previous pod.
Yep, absolutely. So how did you go about getting coaches? Like, because that's probably the number one criticism we have around the place, that we just can't find coaches. We get it. There's no question about that. How did you go about finding coaches for your program, Best?
Yeah, good one. So in Queensland, it wasn't as big of an issue because the calendar isn't as long, right? So there was people willing and that were available for longer, right? So or for more things, I guess, right? So in Victoria, as we know, it's a heavy schedule and the commitment's huge. So the thing that we did was prioritize the development of them, you know. So we created a coach's portal, which had everything on there. The coaches had a log into that. We had multiple clinics a year that were all in my KPIs that I had to run. I had to evaluate each coach a couple of times a year at practice and also at games, and they would receive. We actually had a guy create an app for us so I could just quickly punch it in and it would automatically email them a PDF after the game, and then they would come and sit with me afterwards because I'd move on to another one. So that very quickly created an environment that people wanted to either come to or at a minimum stay in. So I would say out of 44 teams, I think the most I ever had to try and like really scramble for coaches would have maybe been like three or four teams, you know. So that's pretty good. That's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, it's far and away above most other places that, because the hard part is too, again, I like to say we get it, we don't always get it, but if 60 kids turn up to tryouts, really probably 40, like if we're talking that rep level, 40 of them you'd sit there and say, yeah, okay, they're rep players. Maybe the last 20, maybe not.
Yeah.
But from a club and an association perspective, they're like, well, yeah, that's two extra teams though, like that we can have. That brings more revenue, that brings more community around it. And then you've got to try and scramble for those two extra coaches.
Yeah, and you know, because we know that you're not allowed to recruit kids in VJBL. I'm not sure that everybody knows that though, but just so you know, you're not allowed to. And it's, highly unethical to contact kids as well. So please don't do that. But you can, however, have conversations with coaches, right? And I think an important step was the import rule so that coaches wouldn't bring a whole team across with them. And I think that's important so that you're just not having a coach take a whole team to a new association. But when I would talk to coaches about trying to come across, some of them just, you know, through finances or whatever, would move in our area and had been coaching somewhere else for multiple years and whatever. But some would, you know, be prepared to travel from other places and spoke really fondly around the coach development that they got. And I would be very, I guess, politically correct when I would say to them, well, hang on a minute, you're coming from an association that didn't have someone full-time in charge of that. You know, so this is the difference. And this is why I go back to what I started with.
That makes sense. Was it any different for you, Coops? Because it's, I mean, that country calendar is completely different. Like, as much as they're still involved with, say, VJBL and the things like that, and obviously every second week you're on the road and it's not exactly from, you know, Ballarat to Ararat away. It's, you're coming further. But did you have problems trying to work out different programs for different coaches and like the same under 16 team would actually have two different coaches because they'd have like one for country champs, but they'd have a different one for VJBL and those types of things?
Not so much in that respect. Normally the same coaching staff was sticking around with the group, but like most country associations, our under 12s didn't travel. We thought that was a little bit too much for them at that age. So they were strictly a tournament based team. That would immediately come into the conversation if I was recruiting somebody who, you know, I thought was really good, but wasn't going to be able to get on the road every Friday night. Well, you know, here's an opportunity to potentially put them down there. You know, it's a smaller association. We did grow it over time while I was there, which was fantastic. So we did have to reach out that little bit further to try and find coaches. One thing that we did in similar to Bestie was, you know, and I think I've spoken about this on the pod before, but going in with a coach's manual. So something that was, you know, really in depth, you know, values, standards, policies, procedures, style of play. You know, it was a real, you know, Bible for what we're about, and it gave these coaches a fantastic resource and reference point. And that got shared. You know, people saw that. We even got to the point where I offered it to the domestic clubs. I created a whittled down version and said, here, you know, if you want one, here you go. You guys can use this. And again, it allowed coaches to be like, oh, wow. Oh, this is what's happening there. This is the kind of passion. This is the kind of dedication that's being made. I want to be a part of this. So that was really helpful. You know, it was a classic poster. You know, EOI coaches. You know, we threw that up.
You have the old Uncle Sam. We want you on the front as well. Like,
yeah, super absolutely. Old yeah, very old school. And you know, as you guys know, you know, you know, country basketball, it's heavily community based, and so. You know, people wanted to be involved. The fact that we had a pathway, you know, having a Siebel team, you know, allowed you to look at, wow, you know, if I am into my coaching, I can progress. And, you know, there was conversations about that. It was, you know, why do you want to be involved? Where are you looking to go? And then that could obviously help us place those people. We also, I would try most of the people that were heavily involved in the domestic program out there were connected with us. Some weren't, but that was okay. But those ones also were a great place to start and just say, hey, you know, who's showing you something? You know, who maybe has a future in the game that looks like they want to progress in coaching, and, you know, have they thought about, you know, coming over to the representative side of things? And that also helped us, flesh out staffs when we needed to.
So did you have any reluctance with parent coaches and having them involved?
It was very much case by case. And again, you know, like looking across the table at you two guys who were DOCs at two of the biggest clubs, you know, potentially in the Southern Hemisphere when we're talking about organized basketball compared to us, we're dealing with that less and less. But, you know, it would potentially more often it was the best player or, you know, one of the best players. So now we do have to have some significant conversations about, okay, what is the level of this coach? How do they relate to their son or daughter in terms of are they that overbearing parent and we can see that they are negatively impacting their child's enjoyment of the game? And then also, who else do we have? because it's not as easy as saying, oh, you're a parent, sorry. It may be a year where it's like, we don't have anybody else. So what are we going to do? And, you know, in the past, we'd potentially moved a more junior coach into the first chair, put that parent coach in the second chair, so removed some of their role and responsibility to, you know, potentially negate some of that behavior. Sometime we've moved them all the way down to team manager, you know, because we needed a team manager, we needed someone involved, but we were worried about it. So it wasn't so much a blanket, like, yes, we had it, like it was something that was in our policies that preferably we didn't want parent coaches, but we did have to have the wiggle room just based on demand.
Yep. Were you similar, Bestie?
Very similar. I'll just go back to the coach's book and policies, how important it is. I think after my first year, because our book was nearly 70 pages long.
You don't do dot points?
Put the headphones in and just started mashing on the keyboard. And after we printed it off for, you know, 88 coaches,
we decided
to put it online.
Yeah. We decided, you know. They stopped having those extra staff members that they had for a while there.
Here's a PDF link. So, yeah, look, we tried to have a policy, ones and twos team. So the way we did it at Casey was ones and twos teams were considered the performance type based teams. So they were the best kids that were available, top or bottom age, to try and make those teams the best as possible. So if we could, ones and twos, we'd have no parent coaches. But it's the same as what Coop says, like if you don't have anyone, you also don't want to do a disservice to the other nine kids on the team by putting a coach that's maybe not up to it. So it's important to be able to have really frank conversations with those people. And in the few circumstances that we had to do that, I actually said to them before the season starts, you have to agree that if I decide this isn't working, you're going to step down. And thankfully we didn't. We had one issue, but we got rid of we removed the coach and it worked out fine. Yeah.
Yep. So it is a tough one. So, I mean, you've both spoken about your club document, so to speak. I'm assuming what style of play was a part of that and what you want it to look like. Bestie, how did you go about implementing a style of play throughout the program? Like, did you find that there was pushback from coaches of this doesn't suit me or I don't agree with that? Or was it either you like it or you're going the same way that parent coach and we'll replace you halfway through?
Yeah, so first of all, it's a delicate one, and I think every association is different. And when I was first approached by Casey to interview for the role, I flew across from Tassie and went and watched some games on a Friday. And when I went and met with them, it was quite funny because they were all sitting around the table like, oh, so what do you think? You know, and I'm like, bad enough to know that I can make a difference. But good enough to keep me interested, right? So I said to them, this is what I recommend. I recommend total overhaul, you know, with a club that big and that had grown so quickly, a lot of the coaches didn't have years and years of experience, right? So you know, I talk about this often. You know, I would go around to some practices before my first official, I guess, season started, and some of the stuff they were doing at practice was not only not appropriate, but also not even safe. You know, so I said, I really need to take control here. So I sold the hiring panel on style of play, system of play that was aligned with BABV, that type of stuff. And, you know, one of the things that they said they wanted was more athletes in the BV pathway and coaches in the BV pathway. And I think, you know, year one to year two, we went from 5 to 28 athletes in the pathway. But, you know, there was some pushback, you know, some coaches that had been around. You know, we had an 18s, 1s girls coach that I won't say the name, but was adamant that what we were trying to do was too difficult for the players and that they were a Met 4 team at best, which we know Met 4 doesn't exist, but anyway, let's say VJL, whatever it is, and that we were going to, quote, ruin their last year of basketball. So I removed that coach, we put a young guy in, and oh, wow, they made VC, right? So it was an iron fist, you know, and that was endorsed by the board. It was like, you know, I joked about it, like it wasn't a cult, but everyone was drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, like, we're all in. You're in or you're out. And the best thing from it was we didn't have to reteach from year to year. So certain things like press breaker, that carried over. And surprisingly, we started grading better because we weren't having those meltdowns. And we wouldn't have to reteach. It would build. And the most pleasing thing that started happening was you would see the coaches talking to each other and helping each other. And that automatically freed up me for a little bit more time as well, because somebody would be an under-14s coach going to talk to another coach about, hey, I'm struggling with whatever it might be, double back cut or whatever, you know, how are you finding it? And that was amazing for our community. The last thing, and I know I'm taking a lot of time, sorry, Coops, but the last thing is, as a DOC, you turn up to a practice, right? And you're there with good intentions to help, because you want to help at your job. You need to help the athletes. You need to help the coaches. The parents see you there. They want you to have an impact, right? But if you don't know what they're trying to achieve, all you're helping them with is very generic stuff that the coach, that's probably their level anyway. Oh, well, you know, we need to pivot. Or, you know, we need to work on our left hand. Not, hey, this is where our receiver spots are. When the ball goes on the floor, we need to be here. It's same language, same terminology. So you can go in immediately and go, that's not right. Well, that is really good. Well done. You can have a little bit more now. And the same on a Friday night. Otherwise, you're just giving this general like, oh, you guys need a rebound. You know, you're not actually giving anything valuable at all.
Yep.
That's where I felt.
Yep. What about you, Coops? How did you do it? And how are you doing it now, I suppose? Because, I mean, both of your roles technically at the moment are similar to DOC roles, and you're trying to implement style of play and system of play throughout a program.
Yeah, look, it was almost exactly the same. A little bit different in terms of when I got to Ballarat, they hadn't had a full-time or really anybody in the DOC role for about 3 years. The person prior to me was Guy Malloy. So it was Guy Malloy. It was like 3 years of nobody, then me. So the idea
of hiding to nothing there. Like, there's enough gap for them to sit there and go, oh, good, Guy's gone. Or, geez, we really miss Guy. And now we've got Coops.
Yeah.
Like, it's,
yeah.
You know, there's enough space there where you can at least have your own identity, I guess.
Yeah, it was. It was. And it was a very unique situation on some people still doing what Guy had put in, and some people had broken away and be like, this is my time to do whatever I want. And so coming in and saying, hey, look, this is, you know, this is our program wide style and system, was really helpful in that respect. I think the important thing that Bessie spoke about, which we also had, was that connection between the coaches. Hey, have you tried this? And we're doing this. And when the defense does this, we've used this counter, and that wonderful peer-to-peer exploration and coaching and enjoyment. And then the other part too was, you know, when I sat down with, you know, my interview, when I sat down with the committees and the boards and my CEO, you know, I was really clear around my number one priority was the athletes. Is that I wanted to do everything that I could to help them achieve their basketball dreams. That was it, you know, and winning would be a byproduct of that. And again, you know, so we aligned with BA national style play, BVC national style play. We had the same terminology. I know this sounds like a little bit of an echo, but I think it's really important. And, you know, it allowed for not only, you know, seeing Ballarat kids, you know, end up in junior national teams and you're off to big D1 programs, you know, shout out to Georgia and more. You know, it was because of that connectivity, because of that understanding moving through from year to year, because of that ability to go to a country Vic camp like we have now. And when, you know, like my predecessor would stand and say, hey, we're doing this. And the Ballarat kids, you could see them. They ran to the front of the line. They were like, yep, I know exactly what that is. I know exactly how to do it. I feel comfortable to get out there. I feel confident to get out there to show you that I know what I'm doing. And it was wonderful. And at the time, the big three regional clubs in Geelong, Ballarat and Bendigo were all doing that. And I think it was one of the reasons that country basketball was so strong. And I'm myself and Zoe at the moment are really driving to get back to that space, to have more regional clubs, especially the big three, buy into that shared style of play, that connection with BA, that connection of shared terminology to do what's best for the athletes. And that's what it was about, is style of play for what's best to the athletes.
Yep. So just out of curiosity, did either of you design the session plans for your coaches, or did you give them some autonomy in what they were doing?
Yes, both. So
yep.
For us, our teams had two practices per week. Midweek was somewhat difficult to schedule, as you know, with court availability, coach availability, you know, depending what time they're getting there. So midweek, what I tried to do was to have teams pair up. So I try to have one and two practice together where I could, right? But on Sundays, we actually ran the whole age group together. So we ran three pods, if you want to call it, and we did two-hour slots. So all of the under 12 boys would practice together across, like, granted, we had, you know, 10 courts at Casey. So yep. Like that helps. But then all the under 12 girls would practice together. Then all the under 14 girls, all the under 14 boys, 16s and 18s girls would practice together, and 16s and 18 boys would practice together. And with that, I would plan the sessions for the Sunday, and then we would have a lead coach clinic it like we do at an SDP camp. So here's a session plan. I would send that out on the Friday. Here's a session plan. Like, this is what we're working on. And literally, I would rotate around being a lead coach at each one. Plus, I would have, you know, some of those other people that worked for us to do that. And it would be coming to a basket, demo, go. Coming to a basket, demo, go. And that, believe it or not, the coaches were really appreciative of not having to plan, you know, having a demo. And they got a coach's clinic every Sunday. Now, when they went to their own team practice, middle of the week, I would find naturally quite a lot of them would rehash some of it to make sure they got good at it or better than it, right? They might have some stuff that they'd want to change. And, you know, the first part of the year, I would spend my midweek time on the performance-based teams and the best bottom age group. Then as soon as basically classic qualification ended, I was with all the bottom age teams midweek to try and get them ready for the next year. That's how we did it, yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Coos? Were you similar?
Yes and no. So we definitely started with the same template. So session plan template with some basic structures around how we wanted to look, some of the things that we wanted to emphasize, even just, you know, basically having some of our values, you know, on the session plan, our logo on the session plan, some quotes that we knew were important just for that visual, that, and again, that connectivity of who we are, what's our culture. You know, we should be thinking about that, you know, every time we get together.
Pre-stoic coach.
Yeah, it is.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
yeah,
what
yeah.
were your quotes at that stage? Movie quotes?
Movie quotes. No, but my quoting did get so, I'll say bad, but that the end of 1 year, one team actually gave me a book of quotes as a gift as they finished their year together. But I can't think of any off the top of my head, so I promise I'll put some
Look out for on
Twitter.
Pod,
yeah,
you know, on quotes.
Oh yeah,
I like it.
I'll connect it to the Twitter post. But so that was important, and then it was very, very much working with each individual coach each week, and obviously I had the luxury to do that with the size of the program. Definitely had maybe once a month. Would do something similar. Maybe we were looking to add to the system of play or tweak it, or maybe I noticed something right across the program that needed review, and we'd do that similar you know, SDP style where I would come in, I would demo, everyone would have that same session plan, then they would go away and I would obviously be with them. But we had the whole program would train one after another on a Wednesday night. That night was reserved for, really had to be a kind of performance-based practice. So we were preparing for the Friday night, heavily style of play, heavily concept. And then Sunday, the request from me was that was the skill development session. All Sunday, all small-sided games, all individual skill development, getting the guys and girls with basketballs in their hand, develop, develop, develop. Wednesday night, I'm there. And we're refining and we're looking at, okay, what's happening? And then the coaches knew they had to come with their session plan. They would come and grab me, you know, prior to, you know, 10, 15 minutes prior to the session. These are the things I'm going through. Sometimes they would say, hey, you know, can you step in on segment A, C, and D? And of course I'd say yes. Sometimes I'd say, no, I'm good, but can you stick around? So it was really just a very great opportunity to have those coaches plan for what they needed based on the Sunday session, based on their previous Friday night, but also understanding to take into account that this is what the template looked like, this is what our style and the system looked like, this is what our culture looked like. That's what the session needed to look like.
And both of you have hit on something really similar there, that you sort of want to take something off the plate of the coaches as well, like by not having them have to work a full-time job, be a parent or a brother and sister, whatever the case may be, then come in and plan a training session and do all that sort of stuff. And talking to a lot of coaches around the place, some that are at clubs that have a director of coaching that does that for them, some of them are super appreciative, of similar to what you were talking about, Bestie. Like, this is just great that someone's doing this for me so I don't have to think. I can literally just turn up. Others are almost like, well, I kind of miss the thinking. Like, I enjoy putting together a session plan. I mean, that's a skill in itself, which we've spoken about, but there's a balance between the two. And I think once you've proven you can deliver someone else's session plan, you're probably going to get a little bit more freedom to then go and do your own thing to a degree.
Well, this is why the midweek practice, it was up to the coaches to plan. I'm just gobsmacked that it was only a Wednesday night. You know, we had teams practicing Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night and Sunday. So, yeah.
It's a difficult one. And Coach, you touched on the system versus the skill development. How hard, I suppose, is it for a director of coaching to sit there and put development above winning when we all know that everyone looks from the outside in as to, oh, well, this team's or this association's got this many VC teams, so they must be doing a good job. It's like, well, maybe they are, but maybe they're also just winning games and their players don't necessarily progress. How was that a tough sell to people from within the association that, look, hold the course here, like we are having kids progress and develop and coaches progress and develop, or was that just not really thought about?
A little bit of a tough sell. I think when you are demonstrating the love and care and passion you have for the athletes and people pick up on that, that the sell becomes that little bit easier. Also, I think if you've got a plan too, that you can show how this thing, you know, what this thing's going to look like, rather than just saying, hey, we're not worrying about winning, we're just worrying about development. It's like, well, no. This is why we're focusing on development. This is what it's going to look like. And at the end of the day, like obviously Ballarat, it's not the biggest talent pool. Yes, it's a big country organization, but it's not the biggest. And we went in on year one and said, it's about the athletes. We're going to be athlete-centered. We're going to develop. We're going to worry about development. We're not going to care as much about winning. This is how we're going to do it. You know, Sunday's skill development, Wednesday's preparation. We had morning sessions Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday for all areas and all age groups to come in and get extra work done. We looked at ways in which we could bioband a little bit more and move athletes around trainings based on their ability rather than their age. And at the end of the day, for all of my time at Ballarat, obviously excluding the under-12s because they were tournament-based, we always had each of our teams in BC. Yep. It was never an issue. But we never spoke about it. You know, it was about, hey, let's go and do this. Now, the preference was to be in VC because we knew that that was going to be the best competition for us. But it was all about how are we going to develop the athletes? How are we going to make them better? How are we going to have a Ballarat Miners? And I think they're the Lady Miners now. Obviously, they've gotten through different.
They might be just Miners.
Just Miners now. Yeah, they've gone through quite the evolution. How are they going to be made up of, you know, 8+ homegrown athletes? And it's really disappointing to continue to see around the VJBL that winning is valued over development. And I think when we change that mindset, the power of Victorian basketball is going to go through the roof.
Yep. Bestie, did you have similar over there?
Yeah, I think everybody wants to grade as high as possible, but my argument was if you're worth your salt as a coach, you can do both. Right? You don't. And this is where, you know, planning some sessions and teaching through concept-based learning and small-sided games, and this is probably a whole nother 5 podcasts, you know. But the reality is people that say, oh, we're not doing skill work because we're working on a concept, like that really shows to me their level of coaching. You know, you need to be able to work on both, I think. Yep. Probably the biggest pushback that I had was we would do no zone pressing until under-16s. And you know, some coaches felt we were perhaps a little susceptible to being zone pressed because we didn't run it. So then therefore when we practiced it, we weren't necessarily going against what we'd be playing in. But all that took was for me to get onto my whiteboard and design some appropriate base drills and small-sided games, right, that would teach our press break rules with a lag pass and a, you know, a pass fake and someone middle and all of that. So we created games to build up our press break anyway. And like I said, like it's I think the most KC you'd ever had was three teams in VC, and then we went back-to-back years with nine. You know, so it's, you know, and like I said, the kids make an NPP, nearly 30 kids in SDP and state teams and all that stuff. It's just, you can do both.
Yep.
You can absolutely do both. It's just how you do it.
And that's the big test, I think, is that you do need to sell both. Like, you shouldn't be just saying winning is not a thing anymore, because that isn't itself as a skill. Correct. Like, you have to be able to teach players how to compete, and why do they have to compete? Well, they don't always see the development that's happening, but they do see a win and a loss. So I don't want to go completely off that path and say winning doesn't matter at all, because winning certainly matters, but it shouldn't be the motivator. I think it's the reward rather than the motivator.
Yeah, they're two different things, Rob. Yep. You're talking about the ability to win a game, and that's a skill, and I absolutely agree with you. Understanding time and score, you know, how to manage it as an athlete, how to manage it as a coach, definitely. And then the outcome, win with dignity, you know, lose with integrity, understand how to bounce back from a loss, understand how to build on a win. But going out and trying to win a VJBL banner that's going to sit in a dusty room somewhere for the next 100 years, rather than get three kids into a state team or four kids off to college or, lo and behold, on, you know, into the Boomers or the Opals, is just, yeah, that's just a tough pill to swallow.
It is. And that's, I mean, that's a tough sell from a director of coaching perspective too, because there are obviously some associations and clubs out there that will potentially have KPIs around you need to grade at this level and you're supposed to win this many times. It is a hard sell to people that may not necessarily be basketball people to understand that, look, it's not always the same. There will be times where there's crossover for sure, but it's not the only way to get things done. And most people would suggest that the kids that tend to kick on in your association aren't always the kids that make the first team from 12s through 18s. They're a kid that's maybe been on the 2s and 3s in 12s and 14s, developing in 16s. By the time 18s, they kind of get it together a little bit, and that's the kid that sticks around your association and plays 200 NBL 1 or Big V games or something like that. Like, they're the ones that have had that slower burn rather than that meteoric rise, because you're worried so much about wins and losses in that space.
And this is why, you know, I spoke to you, Rob, as well, about when I've delivered a coaching course to you, and I ask coaches, did you guys see a job description? Did you guys get any KPIs for the team that you're coaching? And the alarming look on their faces, like, well, you know, my coaches very clearly knew, if you're in this team, this is what we're working for. If you, like, if you were coaching a team 6, 7, or 8 for us, your success criteria was how many players, because our bottom age, how many got cut the following year, not how many, you know, games you won in VJL 15. You know, like, it's how many players know our stuff, got better, can now go and impact in one of those fewer teams that we have in the top age group, because we pyramided our teams. We had a wide base and a narrow top. So, and that gave them some comfort. Now, it didn't perhaps help them with the pain of losing from a coaching standpoint, but it was about selling the long goal. And, you know, I had some coaches that were great developers. Reese was one of them, who I mentioned before. And the joy in his face, where it was like, hey man, 2 years later, that kid's in the 16 ones. You played a part in that. Yeah, and that's where you got to sell the whole, and it's not about you and your team in isolation, just winning. It's about the club and the kids and all of that. And that's where the group practices for us on the Sundays really built that, because we're all together. You're now in the 12s, you're here.
Yeah, it's such a great point. Story time, Rob.
Hey.
As most of the listeners know, my previous coaching was with Sandringham in NBL 1, and obviously there was a very specific criteria to what the club was doing at the time about, you know, significantly small budget, no cars, no accommodation, no imports, all those sorts of things that we were dealing with. And we lost. I think we won 6 games in 2 years, and I got fired. Campbell Blogg and Tom Coppins are killing it in NBL 1 right now with Sandringham as young athletes. Campbell Blogg has actually become a training player for Melbourne United. And I'm telling you right now, couldn't care less about being fired. And I'm so unbelievably proud and happy for those two athletes. And at the end of the day, we were able to give them some blooding. We're able to give them some time by focusing on development. Yeah, we took losses. Yeah, it wasn't nice to be in that environment, both for the athletes and for the coaching staff that had to put up with me for 2 years. But that's the goal. You know, that was those moments that we now get to see two guys that we gave opportunities to at that level go on and get closer to where they want to go. It's just, it's why we coach. It's just, it's wonderful. So hopefully, some more coaches continue to buy into that side of the development aspect.
Yep. No, couldn't agree with you more on that one. I'm just seeing how long we've been going for, and I've still got like half a page worth of notes to get through. So this is absolutely a part two coming in some place down the road. Just out of curiosity, as we sort of wind this up, what was your split bestie of admin versus on court? Like talking percentages of the role.
Yeah, good one. So now it's maybe my story time. Yeah, why can't I have the button?
No, you can have a button too. Yeah. I mean, you prefer that one than that one. So it's either way.
So basically, when I was working for BTAS, or prior to, you know, many years ago, I actually met with Casey and spoke to him about having someone in a role. They couldn't afford it. So that was fine at the time because I was still small, they were growing, they were still going through the whole life being it was managing some of the venue and all of that down there, right?
That is a throwback.
Yeah, I'm old, right? Yeah. So basically, while I was working at BTAS, the then president and the current GM said, look, we've finally got some money. You know, here's a job description. We'd love for you to come, you know. And I was really happy in my role at BTAS. I was just like, nah, no thanks. And they came back and said, oh, well, what would you change about it? And I rewrote the job description with some more coaching. I spoke to Lono about it, Peter Lonergan about it. And he had said that, you know, you need to make sure that you're still a coach and you're just not an administrator. So we changed some of it. And then I sort of sent it back. And then they're like, well, what about now? And I didn't believe, like, I totally fell for it, you know. So it was like, well, I can't exactly say no to it now. So it was still heavy admin, but I would say it was probably more 50-50, but that was by design. You know, I was on court Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night with juniors and or our academies, and I was on court Sundays, you know, leading sessions. We then had, you know, school holiday programs. I started a program called Future Cavs. And we started a program that's called Casey Select, which was for under 14 kids that I thought we could maybe get into SDP. So I'd run morning sessions with them on a Wednesday outside of doing the Tuesday and Thursday SDP sessions with Casey. So they, like, even when I was on court for BV doing SDP, they wanted that to be part of my hours. The problem was that the number of hours just kept going up, you know. So it's like, yeah, that's part of work, but it went up. So thankfully, probably more than most. And our development officer took a little bit more of the admin with, you know, Aussie Hoops registrations and those types of things. And then we had an office manager that was, you know, really was the delegate and made sure the teams were registered and all that type of stuff. So mine was really a basketball role.
Yep.
By design, obviously. Yeah.
Coos, yep. What was your balance up in the RAT?
Yeah, started out 50-50. And really had to do both. You know, they needed the presence of a coach on floor again because there hadn't been anybody there, and you just they needed the hands-on coaching. But at the same time, you know, we were building a program really from scratch. You know what I mean? 3 years, the thing had kind of crumbled. So that was also frustrating at the time because I felt like, you know, all the work needed to be done on floor. But my CEO was really holding me accountable, and you know, every other day I'm writing new policy and procedure, you know, a tech foul policy and, you know, minutes policy, you know, all these different things that, you know, that meant by year two, it had shifted, you know, it shifted to 70-30, and the thing was moving. You know, I was on court more and I was feeling a lot more confident about, the structure that we'd built through the admin. And you know, big shout out to all the people in the front office at Ballarat at the time. You know, Mel and Glenn White, and yeah, and then guys like, you know, Eric Hayes and Dave Flint, who, you know,
getting your volunteer week shout outs in.
Yeah, early, little bit, yeah, okay, a little bit. But those guys in the office were incredible. You know, Hayes and Flinty, when they bought into what we were trying to do on court, the way they supported me and then supported the program, and we got to this point of all hands on deck. And to be honest, whatever the split ended up being, it never felt overwhelming because of the wonderful support that that community showed me and what we were able to do with the program, and I can't thank them enough for that.
That sounds very good. All right, we'll wrap that up here with the view of there will be a part two coming in one of the weeks somewhere. Thank you both for jumping into this. Once again, a reminder for all the coaches, if you are able to, if you can send through a recording of a thanks to either one of your mentors, some of your coaches if you're leading a program, a player that has coaches that have helped them out over the years, that would be fantastic. We want to try and show the love to as many coaches as we possibly can and thank them for what is usually a fairly thankless job a lot of times, unless you get handed a big book of quotes at the end of the year, in which case, bang on. Like, that's the best way to go. But thank you both for jumping in. Coaches, you can, of course, follow on with the @TalkingSplit on Twitter and Instagram, and we will catch everyone next week. Love, tune in.